Cunningham for another extraordinary message on Gill Athletics Connections.
Here we go, back on the Gill Athletics Track and Field Connections podcast. So grateful that you have joined us once again. I hope you are enjoying season 5, which still, even though we're in May now, that kind of still boggles me that season 5. I don't know how long it might last. I didn't know that it would necessarily last this long, but we're having an absolute blast bringing you coaches from around the country, from all levels. And I'm super excited about today's. You've already seen the title, so you already know who it is. So let's jump into it. Help me welcome the head coach of Minnesota State, the Mavericks. I might have to get corrected on that. The wise, the wonderful, Mr. Mike Turgeon. Mike, how are you, sir?
Good. Thanks for having me, Mike.
Did I nail it? The Mavericks?
Yep, Mavericks. That's okay. Correct.
Good. I really like, I'm a sub nerd on schools and their mascots. Like, I really enjoy knowing all of them. So I kind of always kind of pay attention. I thought the Maverick. You throw me off with the bull, though. It's a bull, right?
Yeah, it's technically it's called our Stomper, is the actual mascot logo, but yep.
So how does Maverick meet Stomper? How's that connected?
Couldn't really tell you.
Okay, good. At least I'm not missing like some obvious, like, oh, dude, all Stompers are called Maverick or something. I have no idea.
I had a coach tell me one time, just work at a school with a cool logo. Kids will remember that.
Nailed it, by the way. Yes, very much so. That is a cool Stomper. I love it. Well, Mike, I'm super excited. Thanks again for being here. You're our second Minnesota State coach, right? So we had your assistant coach, Chris Parno, on. He's an OG. I think he was like episode 30 or 40. He jumped on the bandwagon quick back in the day when we were just a fledgling podcast back then. So super excited for him and the success he's had with you guys under your leadership. Yep. And excited to learn about your leadership and what's going on there at the Mavericks. So let's hop into it, Mike. Let's get in our Wayback Machine here. You know, somewhere track had to start for you somehow, whether it was in the coaching realm or whether it was as an athlete. Where does track begin for you?
Track really comes in sixth grade. I was very, very unathletic, big kid. You know, I was taller than my kindergarten teacher when I started kindergarten.
And, no, are you serious?
Yep, I'm serious.
Were you seriously taller? Was she seriously slower or both there? Because holy cow. Both. Okay, yeah. Wow.
So, I mean, I was, you know, size 15 shoes in fifth grade. So kind of Bozo the Clown right there, Mike. But,
dude.
Yeah. So I had my physical education teacher, Mike Peterson, was also the head track and field coach at Perm High School, where I grew up in Minnesota. And he had told me, hey, you should come out and throw shot put someday. And I remember, I went out in sixth grade, and the first day I tried shot put, really wasn't kind of my cup of tea. And I picked up a discus, and we were in the elementary gym, and I tried throwing a discus and never even hit the net that was like 30 feet away, and kind of fell in love with throwing that, which kind of led me into my career here. So,
hey, let me ask. So I'm, by the way, Mike, I am famous for just interrupting, but I'm curious. So, he's in seventh grade now. So he started track last year. Now he's not super tall. He's not short by any means, but he's not super tall. And thank God. Well, I was going to say, thank God he's not wearing size 15s yet, but you know, I feel like I'm buying new shoes every month. So how that's going to go. But he went out for track, and I'm trying very hard not to push, you know, being the former track coach and track company and all this stuff. I'm like, yeah, you do whatever you want. He's in band and Scholastic Bowl and all this kind of stuff. And so he went out, and, you know, God bless the middle school coaches. I have a lot of empathy. There's a lot of kids out there. We have a pretty good track culture in our community. So there's a lot of kids. I think he's not just coaching the throwers. He's also coaching, you know, maybe the sprinters and stuff too. So they don't get a lot of coaching, right? So they're kind of just throwing a lot, right? Now they do have a really good kid. He's an eighth grader now. He was like middle school state champ or something like that. So I'm trying to balance this, you know, I know enough for, you know, basic shot putting, like, you know, don't fall back when you throw it and all those kind of stuff.
Yep.
But he hasn't grasped into the love of, like you mentioned, and this is where I'm curious for you. You mentioned, I didn't throw very well, but I fell in love. What was it? Cause you weren't very good. It's not, you know, typically we hear like, oh, I threw it really far and I was hooked. You're like, hey, I wasn't actually that good, but I was hooked.
Yeah. I mean, and I tell kids all the time in middle school, I got crushed by everybody. I mean, just because I, I really, in reality, had to learn how to walk and chew gum at the same time. I was so uncoordinated being a 6'4", 275-pound seventh grader, and so it was just something about, watching a discus fly, but early on, it really wasn't flying that
Yeah.
much. It was, dropping right in front of me. But I lucked out with some great middle school coaches that really kind of encouraged me to just practice. And I always think throwing is one of those things that it's just blue collar work. The more you throw, the better you get. And you just throw a bunch and you can get up pretty good in a short amount of time. And that kind of, so that was kind of my sport. And then I really, really liked football at the time. And then kind of as I got a little better in track, and then football, had a spinal cord injury when I was a junior in high school. And then my neurologist, the neurosurgeon, told me that I could pick between three different sports, and I could either go out for swimming and play golf, or since you're a big guy, maybe take throwing really seriously. And I couldn't hit a golf ball to save my life. There's no way I was getting this big body into a Speedo in front of people. And so I decided, really, kind of at that point, I'm going to get as strong as I can and take the throwing, as much as I can do. And so I kind of went all in with that. And
So you were doing up to that point, you were doing throwing.
yep.
Then you got hurt, and then it became, okay, I'm going to become a thrower.
Yeah. And even when I was a junior, I had no aspirations of going to college. I mean, I was kind of, more on the let's graduate high school. And I was working for a telephone company in town, and they were going to pay me to go to college or at a tech school to become a telephone cable repair person. And that was kind of, I had a apprenticeship my senior year with them that I was going to do that. I was going to go to school in the morning and then work for them in the afternoon, and then kind of went through the summer going into my senior year, and told my father I really don't want to give up throwing discus. And that was kind of the first time I think him and I didn't really see eye to eye. And now looking back, it was the best decision I ever made. And then so we so then I ended up going to college, starting out at UW Stout. Do we they There was only two program colleges in the country that had kind of this telecommunication system. This was back, in the early 2000s. And what I wanted to do was become a computer programmer to program telephone systems. It was very unique. Stout had kind of that unique major on part of it. And that's kind of what brought me there. And Dewey Natz, who's now the athletic director there, was my throws coach for a couple of years there. And kind of once I went to college and realized, I'm practicing, September through May, really fell even that more in love with throwing, and realized kind of after my second year, I think I want to do this as a job. I was kind of.
So hold there, because I am curious. I love the uniquenesses of individual. That's why I love people so much, because there are so much uniquenesses. How did you, so you had this apprenticeship set up go your senior year in telephone, and then you pick your school based off of this very, I mean, computer programmer. That's specific. Computer programmer for telephone industry. That's really specific. What was your Why'd you like phones so much? Did mom or dad work in the industry?
I had a networking class in high school and really kind of liked the computer stuff. Part of it, my mom was a guidance counselor at our school, and kind
Oh,
of
cool.
always talked about, going after. She always really believed and still believes heavily in education and expanding, but doing something you like, and kind of the different basically tests I took, and kind of like that kind of realm.
Like
And
the
so.
aptitude test and those kind of
Yeah,
things.
those different things. And
I wish I could remember. We took something. I went to high school in Alabama. We took some test, I think sophomore year, that was supposed to tell us what, job, career path we would take. I wish I could, I would be able to, I wish I would have kept that. I don't know if it came out true or not. I have no clue what it was. That'd be interesting. And when you junior year, when the injury happens and you decide I'm going to become a thrower, how did that change the coaching side of it for you? Did coaches, I don't want to say they took it more seriously, because that's saying that they didn't take it seriously with you before, but did they also double down with you? And what did that look like?
Yeah, I guess really for me, it was I took more of the strength conditioning more seriously. I was told basically I didn't get cleared to actually do any physical activity until, my injury happened in early September, and I think I wasn't cleared to actually start throwing discus until it was right before the track season, like the end of March. And I was just told, okay, you need to go get as strong as physically possible you can. And so started lifting weights 5 days a week for 2.5 hours, and you're a young 16-year-old and you get strong pretty quickly
Yeah,
when you do that.
we just
So
break down at our age if we tried
that wouldn't work for me now. But
that.
yeah, no, I mean, I remember, Mike Peterson, and then I had another, she was a thrower. Chris Keel was a Olympian for the US team. But her college roommate, was a and teammate at Concordia was a teacher in our area. And so Aaron Mosier helped me quite a bit too on just learning a little bit more of the technique. And her husband was a teacher in Perm, so that's kind of how I met her and learned a little bit more that way. But they just kind of encouraged me to keep throwing and keep going with things. And as my wife would attest, I'm very stubborn. So it was, I wasn't going to let this get in my way at all.
I love it. I love it. All right, so we go to UW Stout, partially because I want to keep throwing the discus. Dad maybe didn't understand his, your pathway versus what he thought your pathway might be. I love that. That's pretty common. And then you pick UW Stout because of the telecommunications major as well. And then you mentioned, I think you said sophomore year, it kind of switched. Like, oh, wait a minute. Like, I kind of want to be a coach. What happened? Why the switch?
I spent my time more in my coach's office reviewing video than I did wanting to learn about routers and the different processes on that. And just kind of, I always, then I'd find my spare time too talking, like with our women's track and field coach or our head track coach in his office or our athletic director and learning more about athletics. There was a sports psychology professor that her daughter was a discus thrower, 180 foot discus thrower at Tennessee, and talking with her about kind of their different travel schedule and training, and just really love throwing. And so then when I kind of had a discussion kind of with my mom, with my parents, and talked a little bit more on it, I really think I want to be a college track and field coach. And the issue, Stout at that time had 18 majors, and the closest they had to education was they had elementary ed. And that so I looked at transferring for some schools that were had physical education that I thought would help me, get into the coaching and be able to teach that. And so I lacrosse we competed against lacrosse quite a bit. The funny story, I had shared this with UW Eau Claire's throws coach, but Paul Connellan, who's been a long time successful throws coach there and a lot of respect, learned quite a bit from over the years. And he always had his throwers back in the early 2000s. They were head to toe in spandex. And I go back to my swimming thing. I was like, this big body's not getting in spandex in front of people. So I had crossed them off right away. And then the funny thing about that, Mike, when I started coaching, I had told him the story about that. He goes, "You could have worn whatever you wanted if you would have contacted me." But so I went on to UW Lacrosse. And what was so great though, Chris Hall and Dewey Natz are track and field coaches at Stout. I love Stout. If they had physical education, I would have graduated from there. Love the school, love my teammates. And then, when I sat down with them and talked with them what I wanted to get into, and both of them, straight up told me, yeah, we don't have that. You need to look at a different place. And Coach Hall had graduated from lacrosse, and so he reached out to Mark Guthrie and
Oh, wow, yeah.
wanted to know if I had some interest, if they had some interest, and then ended up going there and learned from Coach Guthrie just so much stuff over the years on just kind of how to be a head coach and how to be a college coach. And then my event coach, Dennis Klein, is also a strength conditioning coach there, and learned, so much about technique and training people. And so it was a great fit for me there, and we had a lot of success there.
I have to imagine Is dad on board now, or was dad, did he double down
he
on the?
He was on board along. I think he just, he was on board back when I was in high school. I think it just took him as a big shock.
Sure.
As you know, because it's
the, by the way, I get it as a dad now. You know, I think about my kid, you know, seventh grade, he's a senior and he's, you know, he's doing okay in track. And then he says, but he's doing awesome over here. And he says, yeah, but I'm going to go do track. And it's like, yeah, trust me. No one loves track more than me, son, but you are really like, you got a path over here. This is going to be hard. I get the dad side of it 100%. Absolutely.
Yeah. And the telephone company is a real, it's one of the largest communication companies in Minnesota. It's based out of my hometown in Perm. And you know, we've talked about too, like if I, we just last summer we were up at our lake and him and I were talking about, it had been interesting the position I would have there if I spent, you know, the last 5 years working in that company. Where would I have, you know, grown in that company too?
Yeah. We do that a lot. I always like to point this out because I knew that's where you're going to go. You're like, yeah, we sat back and it's like, what could have been? And when we do that, when we do that in these forks in the road, a lot of times we only think about the good side. It's like, oh man, you know, could have been there and I could have been the VP of something, something, and, you know, making a lot more money than I do as a track coach. And we think about those kind of things. We oft forget that the other side could also be very bad. You could have gone there and been like, I am miserable. I thought this is what I wanted to do. And you always had, you know, you'd be going through this career with always with this eye over like, what's going on the discus field? What's going on? What could have been over there? And you could have been miserable, failed a lot of things. You know, we forget about that. You're on the right path. The path you are on is the right path that you are on. So I'm glad you chose this path.
Oh, I completely agree. I used to, you know, personally, I enjoyed high school graduation season because my mom would, you know, as a high school guidance counselor, she would go to so many of them. And so I'd end up going along with her. And I was a very, very quiet kid. And I remember she used to pay me $1 if I would sit next to people and talk to them because so I can make some little money on the side, you know. And so I completely understand if I didn't go to college and learn the keys of being able to talk to people and create those relationships, that more than likely I just would have been, I'd probably be a bachelor, working in my hometown. And, you know, so my life has changed quite a bit just because I threw a, you know, a darn discus platter and didn't want to give that up.
That's awesome. I love it. I love it. All right. So midway through college, you realize, hey, I think I want to go down this coaching route. I kind of like the coaches I'm with. I'm digging how seeing improvement and things like that. I'm putting a few words in your mouth here just a little bit. But you know, okay, I can't believe there was only 18 majors at Stout. I assume that's grown since then.
Yep.
So you go, you think you need to be in something like physical education or something like that. So you transfer to lacrosse. I love that Mark Guthrie was the head coach there, by the way. You know, what a legend. What an amazing guy and coach he is. Just awesome. Love him and what he's done in his career. So you really got to learn as now, you know, fast forward, you're a head coach now. You really got to learn what a head coach looks like, acts like, talks like, et cetera. So I love that you had that as I assume that'll be a mentor that we'll talk about here. Okay. So you're at UW lacrosse, you transfer majors into elementary physical education. How does that play out for the rest of your college career as far as athletics and academics? Did you graduate in 4 years, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah. So I started out in physical education there, physical and health education. And, you know, the first time I met with our academic advisor, you know, he is looking at my transcript and he goes, I've never had a PE major with this amount of chemistry, physics, you know, because I had 2 years of basically on the computer science,
right,
you know, that realm. And then it ended up taking me 4 years to get my teach with student teaching. And so I finished up my undergrad there on year six. I had 3 years, I redshirted my first year at Stouts and competed my freshman year there. And so I was lucky enough that, you know, I had 3 years on the team there, and just, we had such a, Coach Guthrie had put such a successful group of guys together, you know, and we had lucky enough that in my 3 years there, we won 6 national team titles. And
Hold on. You were there for 3 years and you guys won every indoor and outdoor title during those 3 years.
Yep. And the year before, that group won an indoor national title too and outdoors. So
we're going to learn, you're very successful here at Minnesota State. you'll never be a success. I mean, that is, I shouldn't say you never, but oh my goodness.
Yeah, they were.
Let's think about that. It's hard to win one. It's unbelievable to win two, and it's impossible to win three. They won seven. You're saying they won the year before. Seven in a row. Dude.
Yeah, they won eight because they won indoor and outdoor the year before with that senior class I graduated with. And
wow.
You know, I mean, it. You know, we're talking Division III, you know, my senior group that I graduated with, we had, you know, Andrew Rock, who went on and was, he was a silver medalist at the World Championships in 2005. Right. So he ran 44 something in the 400. Yep. We had Derek Toshner, who ran 50, high 50s in the 400 hurdles. Hans Schmidt was an 18.4 pole vaulter. Jim Nelson, a 59-foot shot putter. I won some national titles in the discus. And then Kevin Becker and Phil Whitesit were both 200-foot hammer throwers. Kevin went on to be a 70-foot weight thrower at the time, was the national record holder. So, I mean, it's quite a group of kids all the same age.
Looking back now, how did Mark and the coaches – how did you as athlete, I mean, you're 18 to 22 year olds, you win one, especially, you know, they'd won the year before, but you come in, it's your first one. When you win that indoor, it's kind of like, oh man, that's exciting. Like, oh my God, I never would have thought, you know, you can't think of as a 16 year old kid in Prim. Is that where you grew up?
Perm.
Yeah. Grew up in Perm. You never would have thought this would have happened, you know, and now you win. It's amazing. You go to outdoor, you win. Holy cow. The next year you win. How in the world do you keep a group of 18 to 22 year olds hungry to work hard to win the next one? When it seems, I'm just putting myself if I'm a 20 year old and I've won three to four titles, as team titles, I just think it's a given. Like, we're going to win. Like, you know, I ain't got to put in that extra practice, things like that. How did they, you know, you're looking back now, you get experience. How did you guys do that? That seems to be the hardest part, not the athleticism, keeping you guys locked in that you will do the things that need to be done to win the next one.
Yeah, I think a lot of it was just a lot of the key group of older kids that were very successful. It was, we just always talked about we weren't winning by enough. Like, our goal was in Division III, you started out on the men's side our junior year. We started out with pole vault, weight throw, and long jump. We wanted to win it. Our goal was to win a national championship after 10 o'clock, first session was done. And we did that. You know, we had three All-Americans in the weight that year, three All-Americans in pole vault and national champ, and I think another All-American in the long jump. And you know, he scored 40 points at the national meet. We wanted 40 points before 11:30.
Dude,
you know, and that was kind of always our goal on what can we do, and then the depth. You know, at conference, can we go 1 through 8?
Right.
You know, and just trying to look at that. But I mean, it was interesting. You know, how kind of my senior group transitioned through college. On all of us were very perfectionist, type A people to a large extent, and just kind of, we were that way, and it was straight laced, you know, and you know, once you just see all the younger kids kind of fell in line.
So I'm hearing two things. One is leadership. You talked about as the guys got older, they stepped into leadership roles of like, hey, you want to do this, you got to do what we did, X, Y, and Z. I don't care how many titles we've won. And then I heard you say, the way I'm going to put it is, not changing the goalpost, but reconfiguring the goalpost. So now, instead of just, we want to, at the end of the 4x4, we want to have more points than other people, challenging yourself to win it on day one, or can we get three people to score in the weight throw instead of two? You kind of, like I said, reconfigure that goalpost, make different goals is what I'm hearing.
Yeah. Yep.
Wow.
It's just, you know, and we were lucky enough too, to have the Triple Crown in 2002 and 2004 with our cross country winning national championships. And, you know, it was the real key to how can we be successful across all four event groups? How can we have national champions in all four event groups? And wow, can we score points in every event? You know, and
that's amazing. So you're now, when you transfer to lacrosse, you're committing yourself professionally, at least at that age, you know, you're 20 at that point, roughly.
Yep.
Because I'm always amazed that we make kids pick a major and therefore their career path at 18. So even at 20, it's like, you know, you don't know what you want to really do. You kind of meted that out as an 18 to 20, or you kind of proved that out there a little bit. So at 20 though, you're committing enough to be a future coach, a future college track coach, that you transfer and change majors. Those are big things. Did you, looking back again now, did you see a difference in how you interacted with coaches and interacted with your teammates at that point? Because before, almost like your throwing career, you were throwing as a middle schooler, and then that junior year you became a thrower. It feels like you were on the track team, you were, you know, a thrower, and now you're becoming a coach because your mindset is, this is what I want to be. Did you notice changes in how you interacted with your fellow teammates and the coaches, or were you still like, okay, I still got to be the best thrower, so I'm going to stay athlete focused here?
A lot of it is I spent more of my free time trying to learn as much as possible. I mean, I remember going to the library and taking every book that was track and field related and reading it, and then asking my coaches questions about it, the VHS tapes, watching those that they had at the library. You know, we had a biomechanics professor that later on in his life, he went on to be the strength coach for Valerie Adams over in New Zealand. Just learning about more on things from him. You know, we had, but it was also, I remember having conversations with our swimming coach who was very successful, Rich Pine. I always have this big belief that I don't waste my time talking with unsuccessful people. I always want to surround myself with very successful people and learn as much as I can from them.
Well, thank you for being on the show, by the way. I appreciate that. I caught that compliment there. Thank you.
And so like our swimming coach was very successful. And I remember just spending time with him talking just sports psychology stuff on how he did that with his divers and swimmers and learning from him. Pat Healy was the longtime women's head coach at lacrosse and spent so many hours with him. And especially as I transitioned, because the men's and women's team was completely separate at lacrosse, as I transitioned into my first position and was a women's only program at Winona State, learning, he helped me so much throughout my career on just kind of the differences.
You know, that's a pretty mature stance as a 20, 21 year old, that you were able to understand. You know, it's pretty obvious that you jumped in, and it's not always done, but it's obvious that you would jump in and read a bunch of books about track and field, that you would talk to your coaches more and a little bit more in depth of like, okay, give me the next level coach, you know, because I'm going to be a coach one day. But it's a pretty unique and mature aspect as a 20, 21, 22 year old to understand that I can learn from other sport coaches. Where does that come from?
I think I think a lot of it just kind of goes back to my mom on teaching us to be curious with education, you know, and kind of learning from that. And it goes back to my father was a maintenance repair person at a health club in town. So our family trips always revolved around going to different athletic facilities, these community centers, and touring them and learning how they operate. And, you know, and so I think, you know, and it seemed like any family trip we drove somewhere, there was also a community center that we were going to go look at the pool mechanical room. And so it was just always the ability to keep being curious and keep learning. You know, I always look at when you think you know everything, then that's usually kind of when we need to let a coach go.
Yeah, you're in trouble, right? Do you, I don't want to fast forward to today because I still want to climb through this journey, but I'm going to kind of put you on the spot here. Do you see yourself still curious today? The same level? Because if you weren't, I feel like you'd weed yourself out. Like, all right, man, this isn't my passion anymore. I don't want to learn anymore. But you kind of seem like as a 21 year old, you've got that dial turned up to 10 on curiosity, specifically around track and coaching. Are you still driving forward today on that level of curiosity?
Yeah, but it's changed, like still curious with throwing, still love throwing. So I was excited yesterday when we saw the world record.
It's crazy, right?
Yeah. You know, with that. But it's also that kind of as I've evolved in my career, it's curious. And like now in my head coaching role, it's more curious on facility design and building. Or learning about fundraising and, you know, creating endowments and, you know, raising funds that way, running track and field meets more efficiently and just different it's more of the administrative stuff, because I know that's kind of more what I need to do here in my current role.
Yeah, we'll make sure we come back to that, because that is extremely important. You know, when people initially think about getting into coaching, typically they think about, I'm going to do air quotes here, the fun part of coaching, meaning in the circle, working with a discus thrower, a shot putter, et cetera, maybe writing workouts. They kind of think about, oh, okay, that. They never see the kind of behind the curtain stuff that is as important and is definitely part of coaching, the scheduling, budgeting, design of facility, things like that. So I want to talk about that curiosity when we get to the present. That's really important to dive into. Okay. You kind of started, first of all, you said, did you win a couple of titles in the discus yourself?
Yeah, I was third my freshman year, won my sophomore year, second my junior year, which I thought I was in first.
Oh no.
Never would pay attention to other people competing.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought the guy after me was just the first thrower in the first flight. And then best discus wind ever. Just best discus wind ever. And I had in my mind, I was going to throw, this was the day I was going to break 60 meters.
Uh-huh.
I was so worried about hitting that and didn't even think about just competing that day. So I think I lost by 7 centimeters.
Oof.
Everybody else in that flight had great lifetime PRs. And, you know, I threw, you know, about a meter and a half under mine, but still burns me to this day.
Yeah, I could tell.
Chris Jensen was a better thrower than me that day. So, yeah. And then I was able to win again my senior year.
Wow. I mean, that's amazing. I'm hearing this young kid, sixth grade, goes out and the discus, you know, falls out of your hand to winning a national title as an individual, obviously as a team too. That's amazing. I mean, you couldn't have scripted that. You didn't tell me as a sixth grader, you threw it and you're like, oh man, I'm going to win something. I'm going to be a champion one day. That's probably the farthest thing from your mind. And you just consistently brick by brick, put it together and win.
No, and I don't think if it wasn't for Mike Peterson telling me, hey, let's move you up to varsity. So what I hated about middle school track, just hated it, is they made us do, we had to do 3 events, you know, like I'm the size I am.
Yeah. What did you do? Okay. Shot and discus.
So I did shot and discus. So then I did high jump. I had never cleared a bar in my life.
Because you were 6'4".
Yeah.
They made you do high jump.
You know, like, okay, let's do the physics on this. The amount of force you're going to have to create to get right. that big a body off the ground. So I got sick of landing on the bar every once. So then I thought, you know what? I'm going to sign up for long jump. That's not going to hurt.
Yeah.
I go do a long jump in a good old cafeteria style. And I remember the guy not making the pit off the long jump board. And
I remember
the guy going, hey, is that your run through? And I was like, okay.
That is never a good thing to hear.
Yep, never a good thing to hear. You know, so.
I'm sorry, Mike, that's
funny. Oh, no. Holly, Minnesota, where that one happened. I remember that vividly.
As I say, that's.
Yeah. Yep. So
I'm so glad things got better for you.
So then Coach Peterson's like, you know what? Why don't you just focus on throwing and got that worked out? And,
yeah.
You know, I always look at eighth grade year when I got moved up to varsity. That was my best year ever because in track and field, because when the middle school had to run, I would tell our middle school coaches, hey, I need to go throw with the varsity. And when the varsity would have to do the running, I would tell them, hey, I'm in middle school. I need to go throw with the middle schoolers. So I didn't have to do any running that year. Nice. And that was by far my favorite.
It's not called gaming the system. That's called just being smart. They all could have said, no, you got to do it at any point. And you just kept going. That's good. I love it. Love it. All right. You're at UW La Crosse. You're winning team titles like it's easy, which we know it's not. You're All-American, winning titles in the discus as well. You're going to be a coach. What do we do after graduation? What's our first? Okay. I did all this work to change majors and change schools. I'm going to be a coach. What's the first action you did professionally?
Yeah. So I actually still have a year left at undergrad at UW La Crosse. I finished up since I had transferred, I had finished up my eligibility.
Right.
And Winona State, which is 30 miles up the road in Minnesota. My roommate from early on was, he was the throws coach there and was moving on, just a adjunct $4,000 job, you know, at year. And so he goes, yeah, I'm getting out of it. I'm going to graduate and go be a high school teacher in Northern Wisconsin. And so I had, so the coach had asked him anybody that would want to take a spot. So I went up and met with Kim Bloom, who's now the athletic director at UW La Crosse. And so she interviewed me and said, yeah, you're hired. And she goes, by the way, I'm leaving tomorrow to be the associate AD at UW La Crosse. And it's like, okay. So,
wow.
So got hired. I spent more on gas that year. I had a, you know, than I think I made. But it just really was perfect. I got great experience. You know, it was, I always look at, I think it's kind of, it's weird when people on a team, when you have students go from their teammates to now they're coaching.
Yeah.
You know, and that allowed me to go from, you know, yes, I was similar age to the athletes I was coaching, but I wasn't their teammate. And so it kind of gave me a fresh start.
100%.
Being able to start coaching them and kind of learning from that process. And, you know, the coach that I was in 2005, I just kind of laugh at on some of the things I was trying to teach them. What I've kind of learned, you know, now, but.
So a couple things to touch on there. We are so in sync, Mike. This is really scary, actually. So first, real quick question, then I'll touch on those 2 points. You said you still had a year left. Did you throw when you went up there too, or did you just?
No, I had a year left of undergrad still.
Oh, you're okay. Got it. Yep. Of undergrad. I got it. Okay.
Yep.
So first of all, I 1,000% agree with you in regards to the, like the GA type, you know, an athlete who on, you know, Friday is buddies and boys, they're playing Xbox in the dorm rooms. And then on Monday, they're the grad assistant or undergrad assistant coach. Things change. And it is impossible to do it correctly. I believe. So I right with you. I mean, we have talked about this several times. It's like, man, how do you do that? So I love that separation for you, even with the ages, because that makes it tough alone, a 22-year-old talking to a 20-year-old, et cetera. That alone makes it tough. So I love that. And then two, I totally forgot the second point. You just talked about something else. Dang it. Oh my gosh. I'm getting old, Mike. All right. So you're there and now you're coaching, not peers, because you are coaching. So again, another shift has to change, because now you don't have, you're not the athlete anymore. You're coach, Coach Turgeon. How did you handle that?
You know, it was, and what was funny, because I thought everybody in college was just the intensity that I was, you know.
Oops. So okay. Good lesson. Good lesson.
the ladies I started coaching with, you know, I mean, this was when I started at Winona State, they had it, finally their first person to ever make it to a national meet. And since they turned Division II, and so they went, I think it was 12 years to get one athlete who was a triple jumper at that time to the Division II championships. And so when I started my first meeting, I started talking about how people are going to be all Americans and go to nationals. And
they're like, buddy, at the wrong school. Like, yeah.
Like, what are you talking about? And just kind of laid out my vision, how we were going to get there and the commitment level it was going to take. And then kind of started in, you know, and, you know,
did you get any pushback from that? You know, not that they weren't necessarily striving for nationals, but they weren't hitting national marks. So a certain culture kind of comes in at that point. You kind of come in with a little bit of a, like, not a little bit, you come in with a different culture of like, well, the expectation is you go to nationals. There can be pushback with that. And by the way, neither are wrong. Even the one that says, maybe if you say, I don't want to go to nationals, that could be wrong. But, you know, a cult, you can still have a great culture, a great student athlete experience, even if no one ever goes to nationals.
Yep.
But those are two different cultures, two different expectations. Do you receive any pushback?
No, some. I remember early on butting heads with an athlete that, you know, she had told me that, hey, I threw 40 feet as a sophomore in high school, and I'm throwing 40 feet as a junior in high school or college. You know, like, I don't. Like, her identity was being able to squat 400 pounds in the weight room. And I talked with her, well, if you squat 400 pounds in the weight room, only throw 40 feet.
Right.
That's not, there's something there that's not right. So how about we squat 200 pounds, but we squat really fast. And then we start throwing a shot put a little farther. And, you know, her senior year, she at the conference meet throws 43 feet. And like, immediately starts crying, and I'm like, hold on, he just like PR'd 3 feet, and that was like the highlight of her career right there. And
Yeah.
in my mind, I was like, well, you just threw 43, why can't you throw 45 and we get you to the Division II national meet, you know? You know, and I swear that she just won a national title in Moorhead, Minnesota, you know,
Yeah.
when she threw that. But so it was what I had was I had some very talented Kim had recruited some really good kids with a lot of potential that were all sophomores. So I got 3 years with them. And you know, on that really that group kind of spearheaded and did well. One of those athletes turned into a four-time All-American national champion in the weight. National runner-up in the weight the year before her junior year. A couple others went to nationals, and you know, really, really kind of in where I figured out, okay, the stuff is working that we're kind of doing, you know. And my throws coach in college, Dennis Klein, Judd Logan was his training partner.
Oh, wow.
And so I kind of had my in with Judd, and at the Division II meet, Judd Spence, I would just ask him questions after questions. And if I saw him sitting in the stands, I would go be the annoying young coach. And he would never, you know, he would always give me all the time. And I remember one time in Boston sitting there for an hour in the stands, and he was just talking about training with
Amazing.
me, and he'd answer any email I would send. And you know, and such a great guy in helping me as
Amazing
a
dude.
coach.
Amazing dude.
You know, and so that's so yeah, so it just kind of lucked out that I started with some kids that had open minds, that were hardworking kids. And you know, I always looked at what where I was successful at Winona State was recruiting kids from towns 5,000 and smaller that had parents in blue collar jobs, and they started a job before they were 16 years old. And if I hit those Qualtrics with kids, those kids turned into All Americans about 95% of the time.
Now that's interesting too, and we've broached this topic a little bit here and there on different episodes. Some people, so I when I coached, I was known as a big recruiter. That was kind of my, you know, I wasn't a very good coach, but I could bring a lot of good people in, right? But you know, I've heard some people. I probably was like this when I was coaching too, to be honest with you. Now that I'm older, I have more experience, I can maybe verbalize it a little differently. I would have told you, and I think there are coaches out there that have told you that no matter what school I'm at, I can recruit good kids without changing themselves or their tact. Like it's just the way I do it. They'll come if I'm at LSU or Minnesota State or Loras College. It doesn't matter, but it does matter. Your school makeup, the majors, the size, rural versus urban, what you specialize as a program. You know, a couple of weeks ago we had Bruce Jackson from the Academy of Arts, Art U, and you know, they're in San Francisco. That's a different when you start. So you honed in kind of early that. You said 5,000 blue collar job parents and had a job at 16. You kind of started seeing like this ideal recruit pretty early in career, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, it's always looking at, I think every place is different on what makes them successful, and looking at, you know, early on. I mean, one of the things I did at Winona and I also did here was I went, worked with their programmers on, okay, let's look at kids and let's come up with the top 10 high schools of each state. And then, because right to me, Winona was a smaller place that didn't have brand recognition. We were recruiting a lot of We were spending our time trying to recruit, like, okay, the Twin Cities is 2 hours away. Let's try to get a lot of kids out of the Twin Cities. Realized very quickly that inside the 494, 694 corridor, not many students were coming to WSU at the time, especially for athletics in there. So that was just a complete waste of time and trying to target those. So when I started here at Mankato, like we knew that. For example, West Salem, Wisconsin, a small little town, was one of the top 10 high schools graduating kids to MSU. Well, let's see what track athletes are from there, and let's go after those kids because that they already have brand recognition at that school. They already know. And so we kind of looked at that and how we expanded in the Illinois and certain programs into the Milwaukee area with certain programs. And really, it was just looking at who's currently enrolled over the last 5 years at your school.
You're very analytical. You would have been a good programmer. Maybe not in the telecommunications, I don't know, but man, you are analytical with this stuff.
So I enjoy
yeah.
We always talk, you mentioned Coach Parno and I, and I always talk, Coach Parno and I always talk about, he's Microsoft Word, I'm Microsoft Excel, and we work very well together.
It's all part of the package. That's right. Yeah. They call the Microsoft suite or whatever. Yeah. That's good. Yeah. We'll have to figure out who's PowerPoint and who's, what's the other one? There's another one in there. Yeah. That's funny. I love that. Okay. You're at Winona State. You're changing the culture. You're bringing in culture. You also I'm going to ask this a very specific way for you. You mentioned, you know, sitting in the stands, finding Jed Logan. God love him. He was an early, part of our podcast as well. I'm so glad that I was able to capture his story, his journey, before he ultimately passed away. Cause he was special. He really was. And the people that he coached, the people that he influenced, like yourself, Mike, are better for it, are much, much, much better for it. So the specific way I'm going to ask you is, did Mom pay you a dollar to go talk to Coach Logan?
No, I remember my freshman year, they came and they had asked what happened to me after they had visited me 2 months after the school, because I was actually talking with people.
So, they're like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
We've been trying forever.
Yeah.
Love it. All right. So what happens at Winona? How long? You were there as an undergrad to finish at your undergrad. How long were we there, and where do we go next?
I was finishing my education at UW La Crosse.
I was driving
30 miles each day to get my foot in the door coaching.
Okay. I thought were doing like an undergraduate coaching at.
Oh.
Yeah. Got no. it. So you're finishing up your degree. You're out of eligibility there.
Yep.
And you go. That's why you're talking about driving back and forth. Yep. I'm with you now. Okay. All right.
Yep. And so my wife, Abby, had gotten. I knew I needed my master's degree to get into coaching. So I was like, you know, let me work one more year at UW or at Winona. I can get through, got permission. Cause I thought, okay, I'm not throwing anymore. All I'm doing is I'm just coaching and going to school. Why in the world do I need to do a 2-year master's program? Why can't I just get it down to a year? And so I got permission to turn that, basically take 18 credits in the fall grad school classes and, do a bunch in the summer, and then did my internship in the spring and graduated. And so I did that at Winona, and you know, the head coach at the time, Mason Rabarchek, who was he was a student coach at La Crosse when I was there. He kept telling the AD, hey, we should try to get this guy a position. And so the athletic director one day, I remember I was just walking down the hallway, and he walks up to me and he goes, hey, Mike, you want a job? And normally he knew that since I was a bigger guy and people would always contact the athletic department in Winona for help moving when they moved to town. I thought it was bad. I'm unloading somebody's U-Haul. It's like, oh yeah. When, you know, he goes, no, I just came from my president's office. And she said, we're having too many ineligible athletes and we want to start an academic thing. So could you like start some academic stuff? I mean, it was very general.
Yeah.
And I was like, so is this like full-time? He goes, yeah, like full-time job. I was like, sure. And then started that. And then I kind of had to go, you know, then I went way into researching how to create that, how to fund it. I went down to the University of Wisconsin and kind of met with their staff and learned how to build their academic support system that they were using. And, you know, and that turned into getting some grants to, where at the time I left, we had a 5,000 square foot facility that with a staff of 4 people that was grant funded. And we had looked at there, we had increased, you know, the retention rate of student athletes by almost 20%. And so that really took off. And that was kind of really like that, because it kind of goes back to my upbringing, Mike, that when I was a freshman in high school, I asked my parents to drop out of school because Barrel of Fun Potato Chips was offering, they were paying pretty well. And I thought, you know what? I could just go work there, you know? And that was my parents got pretty upset about that one.
I'm literally, as a parent of a 13-year-old, going, oh man, just so when's my son going to do that? He's going to do this. I just know it.
Yeah. So, you know, I was never enjoyed school. never enjoyed school until I got kind of into my lacrosse years with looking at what I knew I really wanted to do.
Passion,
And
yeah.
so I always thought it was great to, just kind of help kids get through,
Yeah.
and kind of create that academic support program there,
Dude,
which took off.
that is so cool. You know, that goes hand in hand. What I'll always say about a track coach, even Mike, you're as successful as any of them out there. You know, 99% of the kids you coach specifically, and this is 99% of ever, all the coaches that are listening right now, 99.9% of all your kids, if you're in high school, 99% are not going to go running in college. And if you're in college, 99.9% are never going to go pro. But every single one of them will go on to become moms, dads, business owners, accountants, doctors, coaches, teachers. That is your real influence. And so you got to like double your influence, not only as a track coach, but creating and growing this academic center for all of the athletics at Winona. That is like, that's legacy stuff right there.
Yeah, I always look at, and I've shared this with my wife Abby, and Justin Lair was my longtime assistant director at Winona State in the academic support. I always looked at what we did creating our academic thing was way more beneficial, and I'm way more proud of that than what I did as a throws coach there. And I had a wonderful, time there with lucky
Right.
enough to coach 5 national champions, 40 All-Americans, and national record holder in 13 years as a women's throws coach there. Like, we're successful on the track and field side, but how many kids, if they didn't have that, probably would have never graduated
Right.
college, and their lives are so different now,
That's right.
and now that academics, and that has stayed, after I've left. And so, I mean, that's always really like
That's
kind
amazing.
of my hanging my hat moment there, is actually creating that academic center and getting
Absolutely.
that to go.
Absolutely. That's what I say. That's legacy stuff. That's not just, oh, he's a good coach. He can take someone from 40 foot to 50 foot in the shot. But that's amazing, by the way. That's nothing, not poo-pooing that at all. But to build, design, grow, fight, I'm sure there were no hurdles in your way to do this, right? To do something that's going to touch every athlete that goes through that school. And by the way, perpetuals. So even after you're gone, it continues to do good. That's amazing. That's amazing. Interesting. You said, so when you got to Winona, there was not a culture of nationals and things like that. You said when you left Winona, several All-Americans, national champs. So you obviously changed the culture. They're pretty good athletic, for the track and field team. There's a lot of people listening right now who either are in that situation or will be very much like you, joining a situation, join a program that just doesn't have the culture of whatever they want to bring in. Because I don't want to diminish cultures here, but how did you, what was, let me ask it two different ways. What was the hardest part of doing that? So you took a 180. So we don't have a culture of nationals. We've got all Americans and national champions. That's a 180. What was the hardest part over that? You said 12 years,
13 years I was at Winona
13.
State. Yep.
Over that 13 years, what was the hardest part to change that culture? And vice versa. I always like asking the inverse of it. What was the easiest part? Maybe something you thought was going to be hard, but actually ended up not being as hard. What were the hardest and easiest parts of changing a culture from not being focused on a nationals or not having that as a goal set to, sounds like that was a goal set for a lot of the athletes at by the time you into your 13 years.
Yeah, the easiest thing which was odd was the facility piece. I had we didn't we had a high school that I remember the first time I had to work with the high school coach or the high school athletic director about, hey, could I use the discus ring to throw in the fall? And they agreed, as long as, yeah, you were done before football. And indoors, we had one basketball court, and right next to the basketball court, I mean, it was all open. It was a gym with basically two basketball courts, and the men's basketball team, who was winning a national title at that time, we were throwing the weight right next to him with no net.
Oh,
And
jeez.
that was a little scary part for me. And you would think about, how are you going to get people when you don't have an indoor and outdoor track on your university,
Yeah.
and all that. And that really kind of what I thought about was, well, why in the world would I recruit kids from beautiful high school athletic facilities? I need to find the kids that have the don't have a track or have the dirt tracks, and then they're coming to school. And you know, I had I was lucky enough to meet Harold Connolly. So he's you know, the 1956 Olympic champion in the hammer. And I had spent a weekend with him learning how to teach the hammer throw early in my coaching career. And I was, and it was my, I think my second year at Winona State then. And I had told him, you know, athletic facilities. And he's like, oh, you just need some, he goes, you need a piece of cement. You need people to train with, and you need an implement. And that's all, and a coach. He's like, those four things, you'll be fine. And I received a little post-it, a little package, and it was a little DVD or CD. It was like a month later with a just a little sticky post-it note on it that says, can you pick out, or said, coach, can you pick out who's in this video? And it was the worst weight room I've ever seen in my life. And it was all this just old metal things. And I counted seven Olympic medalists in there lifting weights and then throwing in a field with no cage, and they're throwing 80 meters in the hammer. And it's like, you know what? You don't need that, you know? And so that was always the thing. I thought, how can I be successful without, you know, I was at lacrosse. They had, we had indoor and outdoor and all these different facilities. And, and so I was lucky enough that the coaches I coached with all came from lacrosse, and we kind of all had the same concept that I had learned as an athlete there, and kind of built a program that we won some conference championships and were top 10 of the nation, and just kind of kept going. And it was just not giving up. You know, when you get, every time we'd go to our conference meet, and, you know, you might take fourth or third, and then it'd be like, okay, what do we got to do better? You know, and it was just, these teams are beating us. How can we beat them? To the point where, you know, we were going, I remember we had a conference meet at, and we scored 79 points in the women throwing events between shot, discus, and hammer. And I remember going back, and we took second, you know, at that meet as a team. And I remember going back and telling our head coach that if we're spending, you know, 50%, we had a very limited, like at that time, you know, like 50,000 in scholarship or 60,000. If we're spending 50% of our money in scholarship on the throwing events, we're not ever going to win conference, because pretty much I'm maxing out the amount of points we can score. So I need to take less as a throws coach, just develop, take more kids on and develop them, so our other other event groups can get better, so we can actually win a conference championship. Because there is nothing worse than me, Mike, than losing. I just, that's, my daughter gives me a hard time, Lola, all the time about that. She always asks me what I like best about track and field, and it's like winning.
Winning.
That drives me everywhere.
It's a lot of fun, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And by the way, you know, when you go into a conference meet, you know, it's very famous. Most coaching staffs will, you know, get the whiteboard and you start estimating all that kind of stuff. I can't imagine doing that with you. Your analytics side might be too much for me on that one. I just have this feeling, you have a beautiful mind up there, you know, seeing all the different, well, if we put this person here, if we put this person here, if we do this with the, you might do over me on this one. I don't think I can handle that. Just an observation.
I actually leave it up to my event coaches.
Okay. All right.
I want them to know the points, how we track it at conference.
That's how tough. Yeah. That's what I'm saying.
That's a little different.
There's no way your analytical mind
does it all. So
okay, I was gonna say, there's no way your analytical mind is not getting involved in the scenarios there. Absolutely. Okay, so we're talking about changing the culture of Winona State when you're there for 13 years. I asked you what was the easiest thing about that, something you thought was going to be hard. I love your perspective there, that coming from a UW lacrosse with good facilities, and you go to Winona, there's no facilities. It's going to be hard for me to attract kids. And you found a way to attract the right kids to the situation. Or hand. That kind of goes in that recruiting conversation that we had. What was the hardest part? What was something that really took a while? You had to dig in, you had to consult mentors. What was something that was just, you know, frustrated for a while, and how did you unlock that?
The hardest part for me was the type of kid you needed to win a national championship. Just constantly, like I look at, you don't win Division II national titles with Division II athletes. You win them with Division I athletes who choose to come to Division II level. So it was just not getting frustrated with nonstop going after the kids. And I'd have parents tell me, well, why would, stop wasting my kid's time. Why in the world are you recruiting a kid? They're going to go, they need to be in a Power Five school. And knowing that that's where, but those are the types of kids I have. And I always thought early on, once I can get one, then I'm going to get more. And I'm going to get a lot more, a lot easier. And so I kind of in 2000, it took me about 5 years to get my first one, Mary Tyson. And she came in and was able to win a national title her sophomore year as a discus thrower. And now she's gone on and been a very successful weightlifter and broke the American record in the clean and jerk. And, but it was just trying to get my first one. And I got told no so many times. And it was just not giving up on that. I mean, it's funny now, early on my first year coaching, getting told no by a 34-foot shot putter, and it's like, and now, you see a 34-foot shot putter come in and you kind of chuckle. But it was just not kind of giving up on that and figuring out what can I do to be more successful with that.
What I'm trying to figure out how to ask this, Mike, without being kind of insulting. Know that I'm not being insulting when I ask it this way. Forgive me for I always tell people I'm from Alabama, so my vocabulary is a little limited here, right? How did you have the audacity this early? You're still early in your career here at Winona State to not give up. I love how you said that. You don't win D2 Nats with D2 kids, you win it with D1 kids who choose D2. And I want to talk about that as well. Like what's the D2 culture? I've been so blessed to go to the D2 national meet now for the past five, I think, championships, and it's amazing. It's amazing. But how did you have the audacity, to have that attitude and then to run into no's left and right and yet keep just grinding? And it worked. It paid off. That grind, that hard work, that continuation paid off. But how did you not back up and go, okay, you're right, we need to start with this caliber of kid and then build. You were going for the bullseye from the get-go.
Part of it, I'm just so stubborn, Mark.
Okay, that's fair.
Just I just feel like Coach Parno and then our other jumps coach, our jumps coach, Coach Sabera, and I, us three always talk about we really get annoyed when other top kids in the state pick any other school. And it's like, well, why would you do that? It's just like we feel we should be coaching those kids. And it's kind of, I've been right from the start. I go back to my time from Guthrie. Why was Mark Guthrie recruiting a 66-foot high school shot putter? Because he can, why not? And so he got Jim Nelson to come to UW Lacrosse or all those other athletes that I was lucky to be teammates with. To me the level doesn't really matter. It's finding the right fit with them.
I love that. I said audacity is typically a negative word, but now that as you answered that, I'm kind of thinking it's like you guys all have audacity, obviously. Maybe that's a positive a trait, a personality trait, maybe you need to have a little bit of audacity to be successful. I bet if I talk to Dennis Shaver and now A.G. Krueger at Ashland and those kind of successful people, I bet they have a little bit of audacity with them as well. Yeah, it's interesting. I have so many questions on you. It's literally spinning my head. This is amazing. I love this. Thank you again for this time. This is awesome. Okay, you're at Winona State. You have audacity. I love it. You haven't said it this way, and I don't get the sense. Sometimes we hear that. I just kind of thought about this with audacity. We hear it sometimes also said chip on our shoulder. I'm not hearing or feeling that from you. You weren't coming out of high school. You didn't apply to the big U and got rejected. So I'm going to show you. I'm not feeling that from you at all.
No, I mean, coming out of high school, I think I actually got like three recruiting letters total. It was just,
Sure.
I had the only one I had sent a couple letter. I had wrote. I remember mailing. We had a one whatever class it was. I remember writing a letter to NDSU trying to see if I could go there. They were growing up an hour from Fargo. That was always the big school
Sure.
that you saw and. didn't have luck with that. But so, and but at the same time, like I wasn't at all. I was, you know, I was on the path. If I was going to go to higher education, it was going to be to a 2-year technical college. And so even when I made that change, I had to take a 7 a.m. geometry class to try to now start making up some credits that I wasn't, you know, in the college prep classes going on. So, yeah, I didn't really, I was a small town kid. So I wasn't like the Twin Cities, wasn't going to do that.
Yeah.
It's a big city for me.
Yeah, it's just interesting. You know, you hear about chip on your shoulder, and that's a lot of times the positive side of, if I'm going to equate audacity and chip on your shoulder, the positive side of it. And I'm not hearing that from, I'm hearing more just like an internal drive of when you wanted to be a coach and be, and as being a thrower yourself, being the best, you know, the study and the analytic side, the analytical mind of you as well, kind of this mesh of this motivation, not the I'm going to prove someone else wrong type of motivation, which is not wrong necessarily. It's just different. You know, that's interesting. It's also interesting. You talked about, you know, Guthrie recruiting a, you know, 66-foot thrower at D3, and the kids you were recruiting there at D2 Winona. And I don't know. I don't know. I saw a tweet today. You know, I live on Twitter, Mike, you know. And so when we're recording this, for you guys that listen, and you're hearing this probably in May, this is evergreen content. So you actually might be listening to this May of 2030, for all I know. But in May of 2024 is when it was published. We're recording this on April 15th. And I just saw the D3 girl that set the national record in the triple jump, 44 feet or something like that, which is, you know, again, it doesn't matter. D3, D2, D1, that's nuts. It was 44 feet. And, you know, at D3 last year, there's a 20-point kid and a 10-point kid. And those are two different kids. And at D2, don't get me started on, you know, we had, oh my gosh, my hurdler from Pitt State. Oh my gosh. What's his name?
Well, just Denisha Cunningham, or sorry, Denisha Cartwright, what she's done.
Denisha Cartwright. Yes. She's amazing. The Azusa Pacific heptathlete. What I'm getting at is, it is true that it doesn't matter the level. And I know we hear about the D1 or bust mentality and things like that, but I saw a tweet today from, I think it was a high school coach, pretty sure. And she just said something like, it's becoming clear every day that it doesn't matter the division that you go to. It matters about what coach and situation you go to. Y'all better start, you know, she was speaking to athletes, y'all better start looking at what coach is the best fit for you, not the jersey. I'm paraphrasing there a little bit near the end. Now we still got to get this through to 18-year-olds, by the way. That's hard. But it is amazing. All the three, you know, and we include NAIA and JUCO in there as well. There is success. There are amazing coaches in every level. And it is regardless of whether you know, to your point at Winona State, it's regardless of whether you have a Crystal Palace track facility, whether you have a Nike contract for your uniforms, it's regardless of that, people, kids, and coaches are being extremely successful. So I love that you are proving this out very early there at Winona State. Okay, so you said 13 years at Winona. We're not at Winona today. So where did we go next and why?
Yeah, my wife and I always kind of had this kind of agreement, though, you know, like when we talked about having children, is kind of where we were located, we were going to stay once we, you know, once they started middle school. And, you know, it kind of just happened that when Mark Shook had retired, they had named Jim Dilling the new head coach. Rhett kind of was an assistant and was the new head coach, was a 7'6" high jumper, you know, for the Maverick.
I've got a great story about him. I'll tell here in a second. Please go. Please keep going.
Yep. But you know, and I had told my wife, I was, you know, when they named Mark retired and they kind of named him right away. And I was like, you know, that might be probably one of the only jobs I would ever leave Winona for, was to go be a head coach there, you know. And I was kind of on a route on, you know, kind of basically three career paths. One, do I want to stay on the career path I am and just, you know, work at Winona State for a long time, or two, go be an athletic director, or three, go be a head track and field coach. And I've always had, like, what I really loved at my time at lacrosse was winning the team national championships, you know. And you know, at Stout, we were successful, you know, as a team, but the ability to go to a national meet and know that your team can actually win and what you do matters more than just the trophy that you're personally going to bring home, that's what makes college track and field special. And I knew Mankato had that ability. They had the facilities, they had the coaching staff, the coaches were full-time, they weren't doing other things. 75% of my job at Winona I was the associate athletic director and doing a lot more stuff other than just coaching. Right. And I wanted to see what could I do if I was just coaching. And so kind of just my kids were in elementary school at the time, and kind of my wife and I, I always look to, before I apply for a job, I need to be able to take that job. And so my wife and I had kind of came over to Mankato, met with a few different people over a Friday, Saturday. I came with it's like 120 some different questions that we had. And
of course you did.
spent all this time asking all these different people, all these different questions, and then doing research on all the different people. And kind of when we were going home, we left like, yeah, we could see ourselves moving here. And then, so we're like, well, why don't I apply and see what happens? And so I was lucky enough to be chosen as the head coach here. And but I just felt everything. They had all the things to win, and we just needed to put all the pieces of the puzzle together. And, I think our first year, we were 30. On the women's side, we were like 55th at the end of the season, and then in the last 4 years, the worst we've been at indoor nationals is third now.
Yeah.
And so it's really kind of taken off, and our men's team now is really kind of taken off too. And so it's been a really fun kind of experience kind of leading that and getting all those pieces put together.
So how many years were you the assistant, and how many years have you now been the head?
So when I started at Mankato, I was hired as the head coach for both the men's and women's team. So this is my seventh year here. I was an assistant at Winona for 12 years.
I thought Dylan was the head coach.
Dylan was the head coach. Dylan was the head coach. And then when he got out of it to go be a firefighter.
Yeah, I remember that was short-lived. Okay. Okay.
I hired Mike to be the head coach.
I thought when Jim became the head coach, you came in as okay. So you came in as the head coach.
Yep.
Okay, so let me tell my gym story. And then fascinated learning this is your first head coaching job. So I yep. always love knowing more about that aspect. So Jim was an athlete there at Minnesota State, and I'm at Division II Nationals. I think it might have been his senior year out at Johnson C. Smith out in North Carolina. And somehow I'm sitting underneath like the big scoreboard on the field where if someone was taking a super long approach in the high jump, they'd be right where I am basically.
Yep.
And you remember Jim Dilling, he took a super long approach to the high jump. And so I don't know him at all. I just know of him because he's really good. He's jumping 7 foot plus and all this kind of stuff. And I was having fun watching. And I also heard he was kind of a, not very, he would have been the opposite of you from what I understand on how he did his approach and what step. I talked to Clifford Velta about him as well. So I believe I'm remember this correctly. He was a little bit haphazard on his approach and where he took off from. And, he just jumped really high is basically kind of his philosophy. So I'm sitting back on the scoreboard, on the concrete there, and he's walking back towards me, and it's the funniest thing in the world. He looks at me, he gets about 20 feet from me, he looks at me, he goes, he don't know who I am. He just looks at me and goes, let's do this, points at me, let's do this, turns around and just sprints at the high jump. Makes it. I was instantly a fan. I was like, oh, it's the greatest high jumper in the world. This is amazing. Yeah. It's like the rock and roller of high jumper. It was, there was no calculation. There was no tape mark for his takeoff point. None of it. He just like, let's do this and turn and ran. It was awesome. I was hoping you were his assistant because I was like, did he head coach that way? I was always curious on when he became a coach. How much can you change your personality just because you go into the coaching seat? I don't know. Okay. Now, you're sorry. I just love that dude. You are first time head coach. I ask every person on the podcast these same two questions, very similar to my question of culture that I asked. When you became the head coach at Minnesota State, you never know the job until you get the job. you can be as prepared. I honestly don't know. I don't believe that our head coaches, I'm doing this in aggregate. You may prove me wrong here, Mike, for you individually, but as a collection of head coaches in track and field, I don't believe we're doing a good enough job of coaching up our assistant coaches to become head coaches one day. I think we talk about it and almost use the word gaslight, gas them up of like, you can become a head coach one day. Sure. But then we don't give them responsibilities or teach them budgeting, scheduling, all the other things that I want to make sure we talk about as well. So you get the head coaching job. What was, it's very similar to that culture question. What was something that when you became, you're the big dog now, you're sitting in the head coaching chair, what was something that you thought was going to be easy? You kind of rolled in, it's like, I'm used to this, this will be fine. And it actually turned out to be a little harder because now you're the head coach. And that inverse question, what did you think? Like, okay, and you know, you're a thinker, you're an analytical guy. So I feel like you're going to have a really good answer for this one, not to pressure you here, but I feel like you're going to have a really good answer. Something that you like, okay, I know I'm deficient in X that I'll need for head coaching. So I'm going to really buckle down, but it actually came naturally to you. Maybe it was a little easier. So what did you think was going to be easy end up being maybe a little hard? And what did you think was going to be hard and maybe became a little bit easier than you thought as the head coach?
So I think the, what I thought was going to be easy, the easy part of the question was really being able to balance the head coaching stuff and the event coaching.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of throws coaches that are head coaches in, you know, all three levels.
Do you think, again, I'm sorry. I love that you said that. Do you think that's because it's hard to coach the throws and be a head coach? Or is it because of bias that we don't believe throws coaches can become head coaches?
I think there's two things with it. I think a lot of athletic directors get a 2-for-1 and hire a cross country coach who's also the head coach, and it saves them money in the department money.
Sure.
The other thing is the amount of time that throws coaches spend coaching. I mean, like, you can't put 20 shot putters in a circle and have practice. Right. You can't put 20 sprinters on a track and have, you know, 400 practice.
Right.
You know, so a lot of it is just time.
Yeah. You know, okay.
With that. But so I really kind of had to learn and found out really quickly, like, I really need like a volunteer assistant person that kind of can just help with the stuff that I was used to doing. And basically, like, if a kid was struggling, and be able to let's go have a one-on-one practice and kind of work through those things that I kind of had to manage. And also this was the first time that I started coaching men. And, you know, cause I was, Winona was a women's only program. And I thought, you know, that kind of answers your second question. I thought that was the flip side. You know, I was teammates for so long, but it had kind of been out of men's track for 13 years that I thought, well, that would be not an issue. And then learned about, okay, some of the little bit of training differences that I had to do or just kind of approaching things, or I felt I was getting successful on creating relationships and getting, you know, the women athletes motivated and going, and then realized, you know, trying to use all that kind of the same on the men's side, but realized I had to do a little bit, some of the changes there.
It made me think about when you said you got a volunteer coach, how did you lose some of your ego and give up some of that control? That makes sense when I say that. You know, you've got control over your throwers. You're writing the programs, you're writing the script. You know, throwing is certainly one of the more marriages between the weight room and what you're doing on the track, even though all of our coaches should be doing that. But, you know, the weight room is, or the throws coaches are usually a bit more in tune there. And you get a volunteer to help out with some of that stuff. That means you got to lose a little bit of control. You got to, you know, the volunteer, you got to trust that volunteer and trust the volunteer is going to do the things that you want them to do, how you want them to do them when you're not looking, when you're not there and you're doing the other activities. How did you handle that control side? Yeah,
a lot of that was just giving up and like, or not giving up, but like,
yeah, no, I think
having the ability to know that, okay, I need to put the person in a position and kind of, I always look at it as like an efficiency meter. My kids always make fun of me about efficiency, but I always look at what I'm doing. Should the state of Minnesota's taxpayers, is it cheaper for them to pay somebody else to do that job than me. And looking at, it's not a value use of time. So then trying to just find people to kind of do those types of things. But it was the first time in my life I had to give up, you know, I started writing the weight room stuff, you know, but as an assistant, I was in the weight room with our throwers and doing all that and realizing to, okay, how about I just write it, but then have the strength coach go through with it, to now completely where I have nothing to do with the strength training stuff. And it took me a couple years to go and a couple different people to let that go. But now
I
100% love it. Like, it takes so much stuff off my plate.
That's huge. The weight room specifically part. And again, you know, I talked about the marriage of throws coaching in the weight room. Let me ask it a different way. How hard was that for you? Because that's a very controlling thing. And you hear the opposite, actually, where, you know, hey, track coaches, you need to be in that weight room. You can't just let the SNC coach do it. They don't know what they're talking about. And certainly there are, you know, I've seen both sides of it. I've seen the very poor SNC coach who does not care what you're doing on the track. He or she's going to do what they want to do. And then I've seen the other where it's like, hey, what are you doing this week? Because I want to make sure I'm programming the right way. You had that expertise, that experience, and you were able to let go of it. That seems like that's a big, not loss of control, but giving control to someone else.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of odd. Like, when I thought I started coaching here, like, I thought my track and field coaching was going to prepare me for the head job here, you know, but it was actually my associate athletic director and my administration background that actually helped me by far the most.
Right.
It was just really understanding that, yes, coaches are important, but they have they're one piece of the puzzle, you know, but they're all these supporting roles that go into it to make these kids successful.
Right.
You know, I mean, to the point where, you know, 2020, we had a phenomenal team set up, we thought, and then we had a whole bunch of, I mean, we didn't have the academic support stuff, and we had to get that going. Because you can have the best athletes in the world, if they're ineligible, it doesn't matter. It's just a waste of time, you know, for everybody. So we've spent a lot of time on getting kind of the academic support arm really rolling, and being able to work with some departments on campus to build that up. You know, the same with where we needed to see athletic training really grow. You know, and where when we started here, I had a graduate assistant for 20 hours a week, and now I have two full-time athletic trainers for the track and field program, you know, to where we're able to grow that. And, you know, it's just all those little pieces of the puzzle to get that. Because, you know, I look at, you know, every coach, if you coach long enough, you're going to have great athletes. You're going to find somebody that's just going to all once come out of nowhere, and they're going to do something good. But it's like, you need a system created if you're going to have a long time and successful teams that keep going.
All right. So how many years at Minnesota State now?
Seven.
So I don't want to ask it that way. How have you changed the culture at Minnesota State? You have your own culture that's built from a lot of different experiences in your background. So all the way back from UW Stout, all the way back from high school, actually, UW Stout, UW La Crosse, Winona State, you're continually developing your culture because of influences on your life. You know, Judd Logan, et cetera. Those are all influences. Hal Conley, those are all influences of your culture, your life. So when you come to Minnesota State, whether they were ultra successful or not, you're still going to change culture because now you're the head honcho. You drive that culture. How have you changed the culture? What are maybe some specific things that you've done to help build to the success that you guys have today?
I think our biggest thing is the expectations on, you know, and realistic expectations too. Like, you know, I know that our women's track team is funded dramatically better than our men's. So like our women's program, like if we have the resources in place and the staffing in place, we should be a top four program every year. Mm-hmm. You know, minimally of a bad year should be still top 10. You know, our men, you know, we're getting through fundraising and all that, getting up there, but yes, our men should be 10th place. And I look back to 2 years ago or 3 years ago when we won our national championship on the women's side, you know, our women were first or second all year and we ended up winning, but our men came into the national meet ranked 16th and took sixth. And I felt that, I told our men's team afterwards that I thought that was more impressive, you know, and that's, we're taking a team that was 25% funded at the NCAA level and came in and took sixth in the country.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that was pretty insane.
Yeah.
You know, and then what's unique with track, I mean, you think track to win a national title, you need all these people. And in reality, we won a national title with five athletes. We had three throwers and one that was a sprinter jumper and one sprinter, you know, and those five athletes scored the 50 some points we needed to win.
Amazing. That's amazing. Well, so when I was at Mississippi State, that's kind of what we were going for. We couldn't win the SEC. We couldn't win the conference because of depth with some of those other monsters out there. But we wanted to win nationals. And to your point, we knew it was like, okay, 5 to 8 athletes. You still got to hit, quote unquote, perfect and might need a baton drop somewhere else. But, you know, a mistake made, but you could do it. So what was it like winning that first title? I mean, you've had the experience as an athlete, but it's different as a coach. What was that like?
It was different because, you know, the year before we were second. You know, it's always the first time you do it. It's really special. The first time we won a conference championship.
Yeah.
Like how special that was. Yeah. And the men, we won right away. And the men have won like 22 conference championships straight now. You know, but the first one we won.
Wait, did you say you guys have won 22 conference championships in a row?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you're just selfish, Mike, is what I'm starting to figure out here. Holy cow. Okay, good.
And we knew once we got our women's team turned around to where we wanted them, that would start to happen, you know, and so we've been successful on the women's side here as recently over the last few years. But, you know, it's really special the first time, and then, you know, but you got to keep it going, you know. But it looks at the first time we were second, you thought our team won a national championship. Mm-hmm. The next year we won a national title. The following year, last year, we – you know, we're first all year and we just had a rough national meet. I mean, if there's something that could go wrong, it went wrong for us. And we lost the national. I mean, it was by far the worst meet I've had in my college career. And we lost the national championship by a point. And because we thought we were going to go in and score 80, 85 points and, you know, scored 50 and Adam State. They scored a lot in the distance.
Yeah.
And scored 51 and one.
It's never over with those guys.
There was not one athlete that wanted to take a photo with that trophy. Nobody touched it. You know, I still to this day, I don't think I've ever touched our national runner-up trophy. But the 2 years before, the first time we were second, I mean, that was the most photo.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Same place.
And then
totally different attitude towards it. Wow.
Yeah. And then, you know, then I look at last year outdoors, you know, we were kind of third or fourth all year ranked or worked our way up to fourth. I mean, every week got a little better for us. And then we ended up having a great national meet. Team takes second. Everybody wanted to take a trophy with that or a picture with that. You know, it's just such a different, you're just the expectation level.
Yeah.
You know, so.
That's interesting. The same thing, second place, it's the same thing, whether it's 2020, 2024, 1980, it's the second place. And yet the difference in attitude, expectations, happiness levels, that's really interesting. That's really interesting. Okay, Mike, let's spend some time, here at the end, let's talk about you're obviously an accomplished coach. So we don't talk about X's and O's. So we're not going to try to figure out why, you know, how you get all these All-Americans and national champs and the throws and all those kind of things, but it's evident that you are a very good general. You're a good leader of other people. And we've been talking a lot about that leadership as it relates to the athletes. I'm curious, let's flip it a little bit here. When you become a head coach, when you're an assistant coach, and I don't think we realize this sometimes we do, but most of the time, I think we don't realize this when we're in it. And you can be excused for not realizing when you're in it. Being an assistant coach is easy. I know there's a lot of pressures on you because you got your event group and you got to do well and head coaches on you and all those kind of things. But when you become a head coach, and we talked about this earlier, we hinted at it earlier, there's just so much more. In fact, when I asked you what was the thing that you thought was going to be easy, it actually became a little hard. Your answer right on point here was, yeah, I thought it'd be fine to, you know, coach my kids and still do all the administrative stuff that I have to do. And you're like, yep, that actually became a little hard right off the bat. Like I realized, oops, that was a mistake. That's going to be hard. So how do you, let's start first with staff management, because you got a great staff there. Including, you know, good friend Chris Parno, you know, obviously I start with him with things. We talked about culture of the team. How do you influence, affect, coach your staff to have the same or similar, you know, we're not carbon copying here. It's they are all individuals, but how do you raise their level to your expectations? I don't want to get into like specifics like, oh, you know, with Chris one time I had to wag my finger at him. I know you didn't have to do that with Chris, but you know what I'm saying? Like, how do you keep the staff on the same page, keep the same expectations, keep the same motivations to go after D1 athletes so that you can win D2 nationals? How do you, as a staff manager, handle that part of the job?
The biggest thing for me, Mike, is have great people that are way different than what I am and stay the heck out of their way and just basically support them, you know? And so that's the biggest thing we talk about. We talk about winning, and in reality, I don't know if Chris and I have ever talked about legs of 4x1s or 4x4s. Sometimes he'll just tell me, hey, this is what I'm thinking. What do you think? You know, but it's 100%. I just want him to run his thing. Like I look at event coaches should be head coaches, and it's my job to just support them in their position and help them through it, or help them work through a problem, or if they need something administrative support wise or logistic wise, and help them with that. You know, and like, for example, like Coach Parno I'm one of my downfalls is I am not a public speaker. I don't like getting in front of people and talking to them. Mike, it took me some convincing to even do this.
Well, thank you for stepping out of your comfort zone then. I appreciate
way that. Out of my comfort zone. I'm not a fan of talking to myself.
Excellently. Let me just say that you really are, brother. Absolutely.
So like our team meetings. Like a lot of times, like I'll have our kind of more of the logistical side of things, but yeah. I'll let Coach Parnell do more of the rah-rah.
I'm shocked that he's so good at that.
you know, he loves that stuff and it works out really well. It's finding what each of our assistant coaches are passionate about and letting them shine. But we all keep talking about winning. I mean, we got on the bus back from Pitt State after we won our national championship, and the whole discussion for the next 3 hours, I mean, we left at 10 o'clock at night, and the whole discussion the next 3 hours till 1 a.m. was about recruiting and who's still available out there.
Wow.
And what can we do? And what are some of the kids that we can get to? How can we get our men's team from 6 up farther? Are we doing, you know, what are we doing right or what went wrong? Or looking back at the national meet, was there things that travel time or whatever, right, things that we could have improved on? And so it's really that. It's not, I don't have really any secrets. It's just.
Well, you really nailed a great leadership line there. Have great people. So you hear this a lot. Have great people and stay out of their way. I've heard that a million times, and it's important. I'm kind of downplaying here a little bit, unfortunately, but that is really important. You added something in there that I thought was really unique and important. Have great people, and then you said, who are different than you, and then get out of their way. I've heard a line that, you know, great leaders, like what makes a great leader? Well, all different types of personalities can be a great leader. All different types of communication styles can be great leaders. What makes great leaders is people who are higher people that are not good at this, or that are good at the stuff that they either aren't good at or don't like to do, and then get out of their way. So that's what I kind of heard the way you said it was, that are, who are different than you, people who have other skill sets, whether it's obviously the coaching side, so sprints and hurdles versus throws, and then you know, maybe more extroverted than introverted, and then let them say, okay, good, I'm going to bless you to, I'm gonna support you to be as good as you can at that, because I'm really good at this part over here, and I'm going to be gassing myself up over here to do these things, because together we'll lift the whole program up.
Yeah. And I look at when Brian Sabera is one coach on our staff. He's our jumps coach and multis coach. And, you know, and I really, like, early on when I got to know him, he used to be the former head coach at St. Cloud State. And just, I'm always watching coaches coming up and how they're interacting with their kids. They have no clue that I'm doing that, you know, but how they're interacting with their kids at meets, how their kids are responding to them. You know, are they staying put, or are they jumping ship every year? But then just seeing them, are they different at a regular meet than a national meet? You know, some people go to a national meet and all once they're changing everything in the world, and it's like, well, that's not what got you there.
Right.
You know, and then just kind of having my lists of people that I have, you know, if coaches change, I need to be prepared for all that.
That right there might be, you know, we have a ton of assistant coaches that listen to the podcast. That is really, like, when you go ask someone, you know, how can I get this job or that job, or how can I become a head coach one day, et cetera, that might be the best advice that can be given right there, Mike, is, hey, someone is always watching. So conduct yourself with the high integrity that you have all the time. All the time. Someone's watching you. And that is the best. When there's a position open and a coach like Mike already has a list and you're on that list, you're ahead of the game. But you only get on that list if you're doing the right things at the dual meet up to the national meet. Do the right things each time. And when you stack, you know, you do the right things, you make the right decisions over and over, from little ones to big ones, those stack and become huge ones. That's how you end up. That's how you've won a national title, Mike, is you guys have taken a lot of little and medium and big size decisions and done the right decision and stacked and stacked and stacked until it ends up with a national trophy.
Yeah. And I mean, that's as simple as, you know, things that I'm looking for, like, you know, you're just having a little side conversation with an assistant coach, and are they talking about how they could be doing their head job coaches better, or their athletes are. And, you know, it's just all little things that accumulate that you have. But then it's also kind of helps my coaching friends that, you know, like, if I can recommend somebody to them, I'd be like, oh, yeah, this person at this other school that I really respect, you know, and kind of help that way. You know, a big thing has always been for me, you know, I've had now 12 women throwers that have gone on to be collegiate coaches.
Is that right?
You know, and you know, and I always look at what I always, there, you know, there definitely, there's been a huge uptick in the amount of women coaches in college track and field, but just kind of, that's always been a big kind of passion for mine, you know, started in my earlier coaching days, but just also, if I see an athlete that I think would be the coach, really try to help them where it might be just something as simple as, hey, why don't you come, you're at the 3 o'clock session. Can you come at the 1 o'clock session? I have a bunch of freshmen. I want you to help me out with the hammer. And then kind of help them, teach them a little bit on how to do that and kind of blossom that. But
the greatest superpower of a coach, specifically a track coach, is seeing things in other people before they can see it in themselves, man. That's awesome. So you're not even talking about athleticism of like, hey, I believe you can be a 50 footer in the shot one day. You're talking about, hey, you know what? Like, you could be a coach one day. Like, that's an amazing, amazing ability and trait. I love that. That's really awesome. Okay. We talked about, so I told you, you know, before we hit record, you know, your journey is important. And I love the journey that you've been up to today. And that I love that your journey is continuing, by the way. This is not even like, maybe if we're going to use a quarter mile as a reference, maybe you're at the 150 mark. You still got a long, long pathway in front of your career. So I love that. But I also told you, you know, the other part that has made this podcast so popular is the value that the guest brings. And by the way, you're knocking it out of the park on that. But I'd like to talk about to continue the conversation of the well-roundness of a coach, not just the on-the-track coaching component. We talked about staff management. I asked you, earlier in the show about your staying curious, and has that, you know, continued to stay cranked at 10 today? And you mentioned, yeah, but differently. So maybe not a 10. And I'm sure you're still at some level with training and things like that. But you said, you know, at a 10, yeah, I am, but it's off the track stuff. You mentioned facility design, budgeting. I'm trying to think of the other things you mentioned. Talk to us about. So we also have a good number of athletes that listen to the podcast. They're typically junior to senior in college, and so they're thinking about coaching. So they're listening to coaches like yourself. Again, we get very much into the trap of we think coaching at any level is, oh, I'm just in the sandpit coaching long jumpers. That's what the job is. That's, and you know what? Oh, sure. I'm sure I got to do some paperwork, but 80% of the job is on the track. And that's not true at all. Talk to us about how you are continuing to develop holistically as a coach and think getting better at those items that you mentioned that you might also mention now.
Yeah. I mean, going back to the kind of the question you brought up about coaching, you know, I was just at the dentist this morning and the lady asked me what I did and I was a college coach and she goes, well, what do you do all day? Like, you know, and you always get those questions.
Yeah.
But you know, as an assistant coach, I always look at, and I told our assistants when we started that I wanted them to do what they're good at, and that's coaching. And so trying to figure out, we were spending so much time with the academics. Coach Parma spent a lot of time doing academic stuff, and I wanted to get that off his plate so he could just spend more time coaching and recruiting. You know, we're always trying to make our kids better, but then recruit kids better than our current kids. Mm-hmm. And so it's, for me, it's just been learning more things about that. You know, I've been very curious on, I didn't have much fundraising experience in my previous role in job, and now that's a big part of it. And so I've had to really learn how to do that, engage people. How can we market track and field more? And really try to build that up. You know, another big piece, you know, we host a lot of track and field meets at MSU. You know, it's almost, you know, we just got done with our 14th high school meet. You know, we did
this year.
Yeah, this year, 11 indoor days, indoor college meets. You know, we have just had a huge high school or huge college meet here, you know, and so it's just learning every time we have a meet, you know, and we've done this for 7 years, and Tuesday at 10 is our staff meeting. I know it's cringy for some of our assistant coaches, but we go through, even we've hosted our indoor conference meet 7 times, we still spend a half hour discussing what things we can improve on. And how can we make that better? Now, those meetings were a lot longer early on, mm-hmm. But we've really been able to make it. I mean, you know, down to it that we always, you know, we always have a goal that, you know, as a field event background, it was always annoying to me when I'd go to track meets and the track would get done and then there would be field events going on for 4 hours. And we always try to get it where the last throw, you know, the last pole vault, the last long jump is also happening during the 4x4, you know, and, you know, can get it down to throws. We're pretty good now. We can get it down to within 5 minutes of predicting when all the throws are going to be done at the time. Pole vault's a little bit more trickier, but long jump's pretty simple. Different times for different officials that we have, different times for different genders that we have. But just trying to make that more efficient, you know, and then it's just looking at, you know, like I knew a few years ago that athletic training, you know, they changed the standards that you could used to have a bachelor's degree for athletic training. And now it's going to go to a master's degree. Saw that as a big hurdle for track, you know, for our program here, what we were going to do, and then had to learn a lot more about athletic training and figure out, okay, how can we expand this model? You know, and it's kind of looking at taking basically the biggest threats that I have to our program that are preventing us from being more successful, taking one and trying to just fix it and then move on to the next one, you know, and not trying to, I think where some people might look at where they look at everything that's going wrong and then try to fix them all at once and you don't really fix them. It's like, okay, let's like, I knew for our thing that the first thing I had to do is we had to remodel our indoor track because the surface was old and that was going to cut down on some of our, you know, some of our issues that we were seeing. And so it was how to, I know I'm jumping all over the place, but there's two types of fundraising. There's internal fundraising at your university, and there's external fundraising.
Oh,
And
explain that. That's important.
Internal fundraising is getting your university to come up with the funds. And that I've had experience with. External fundraising to me is the easier portion of it.
Okay.
And it's just trying to get the people that make the decisions to kind of get it your way and what they're passionate about, you know, and it's the other flip side, I guess, for other, since this is more for a broader coaching thing, you know, I look at is it's not the people. You have people in higher ed leadership and VP roles. The most important people are the people one step below them that you find that are successful, that you know in the next few years are going to be in those roles.
Mm.
And you start getting them attached to your program now.
Mm.
So that as they move up in their careers, they're already a big believer in your sport, especially if you're at a place that you feel you're going to be there long term. That'll help you grow your program, you know, or a huge portion for us is, you know, we have our inclusion diversity office is almost basically funding two full-time positions for academic support, you know, and that's relationships we built through track and field and helping with that, that now has kind of really fixed our academic support stuff that I had. And now I don't have ineligible athletes. All our athletes are graduating, and we're keeping our high academic or our higher, basically our higher risk athletes. And we know we have the academic support for them.
Wow.
And they're going to graduate.
You know, Mike, I encourage track coaches to go into administration. You've been in administration, but I encourage our track coaches to go into administration because, you know, a lot of important decisions of our sport are happening in those conference rooms with administrators. And so I'd like for someone who has experience with our sport to be in those meetings. So it's interesting. I don't want to say you came from the administration, but you have a very large administration background with the academic side there at Winona and stuff. And you're doing an amazing job as a coach and as a head coach. And you know, I guess if you have still a lot of runway in front of you, but man, you as an administrator would be really important for our sport, not only at that school that might ever happen, but also in that conference and on the national level as well. You just have a great brain about it, just the analytical side of what it is. So I just want to encourage you, you know, as you continue through your career path of, you know, that maybe it's not over, that administrative side for you. So just want to encourage you with that. Mike, to wrap us up, what's got you excited, man? There's a lot of things to be excited there as a Maverick, as you look forward to, maybe you get to choose what future here. Is it this season, 1 year, 5 years? What's got you excited about your program there?
The biggest thing, Mike, is just kind of the growth, all the grinding and not giving up that we had over the, you know, the last few years, just kind of seeing that all come together, seeing our athletes that, you know, I mean, when we sit down and start talking about them, and then early on in the recruiting that we have chances at, you know, I mean, we've really tried to expand our international kind of recruiting with that. And, you know, and that's been really gone really well for us. And one of the big things Coach Sabera brought to us with that. And then just the biggest thing is just growth. Like we want to keep growing as a program. We kind of like our roster kind of to stay kind of where it's at. You know, we've gone where a lot of our coaches believe in a bigger roster. We think the depth helps you sustain conference championships really well. You know, so we do have a larger roster program on the side. You know, we started the year about 194.
194.
Yep. So we're,
you said large roster. I'm like, oh yeah, 100 athletes. That's a lot. Double it. You're at nearly 200 athletes and you are, this is awesome. Cause some people think it's inverse proportional that the larger your roster, you can't win nationals cause you can't focus on the athletes, the five athletes you need, things like that. Your staff are able to do both 200 athletes nearly and pushing for national titles. Wow.
It's a lot harder. I would say that it depends on your coaching staff. Like I'm lucky enough that I have coaches that have been here a long time that are a little older that, you know, I mean, they run their event groups, and we have a plethora of volunteer assistants that are trying to get experience to move on that help out with that. But I mean, Jerry Baltus has been, doesn't know it, but a good mentor of mine since I've been in the head coaching role, just kind of seeing the success he's built at Grand Valley. And, you know, they've done it with a large roster, you know, public
true.
School like ours, a little larger school than ours, but just the success he's had, you know. So
it can happen. You can do it. I love it. Growth. You're excited about growth, continued growth. I love hearing that from a guy who's won a national title. Cause again, it's easy to sit on our laurels and be like, hey man, I've done more than 99% of coaches will ever do that will ever win a national title. So I love the continued vision towards growth and growing the program, growing yourself and growing your staff.
Yeah. Appreciate it.
I love it. Thank you guys. We're going to wrap it up right there. Mike, thank you so much, man, for, you know, I say this to everybody, I'm amazed because this is not an easy podcast to listen to. So I always love you listeners being here all the way to the very end because it is a longer than normal podcast. But that also means it's not an easy podcast to record for. I ask for 2 hours of your time during off season. That would be extremely hard. But right now, Mike, I'm so grateful for you. You're coming off of hosting a track meet. You're staying conference and nationals in front of you and you're able to give me your time. And that's one of the most important and valuable things you can ever give me. So I'm really, really grateful for your time today. And you've just really killed it with the value, my friend. It's amazing that really you're still a young part of your coaching career here. The experiences you've had, the lessons you've learned, and you continue to keep that that grindstone mentality of growing and getting better every day. So I'm just so grateful for you and really thankful for your time.
Appreciate it, Mike. Thanks for everything you do for our sport too and promoting it.
Absolutely. You deserve it. Guys, thank you for being here. Join us next week. I think we're in the middle of May when you're listening to this. So we've got nationals, conference nationals coming up. We got the summer track. We're going to keep bringing amazing people like this to the podcast every week. So join us next week. We'll do it all over again. Thanks, everybody.
If it goes to appreciate the coach, the ones who point people most. Every season needs a voice of reason, speaking of growth. Gotta prep before you carry the load. It's coffee to the soul for those of us who stay on the go. Proper handoff to stay in the zone. What you packing for the road? There's more than one way to go. Take notes, that's paying your toll. It ain't practice if your purpose ain't clear. It can't happen till you listen with both ears. You can't mentor without a mentor's years of experience. You can reinvent those years. Every plan's got a standard to live up to. And the price sacrifice, can you give up you? It's a choice and a fight, not a win or lose. It's not a ploy, but advice so y'all can make more moves. It's not about how to, it's all about why. You don't know till you know who you are inside. 6 million ways to tie, choose none. Till we all cross the finish line, the work ain't done. So we learn from the experts, we all gotta put in the legwork. Gil Athletics is a network, it's all about connections. Put together for the profession, so every track coach can be your blessing.